Welcome to Sleepover Cinema, where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of those who would gladly punch Jason Bateman in the face. I'm Hannah Leach.
And I'm Audrey Leach. We are the sister filmmaking duo also known as Two Pink Pictures, and we have not stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them.
We're going to explore the good, the bad, and the nonsensical of the movies that first inspired our love for film in an attempt to answer the question, are these movies actually good? And at the end of the day, do we really care if they are?
Today we are talking about 2007's Juno.
Yo, 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 yo. I'm pregnant.
What? On this block?
I've taken like 3 pregnancy tests and I am for shiz up the spout.
How did you even generate enough pee for 3 pregnancy tests?
I'm telling you I'm pregnant and you're acting shockingly cavalier.
Is this for real?
Yes. Forget Tyler.
That ain't no Etch-a-Sketch. This is one doodle that can't be undid, Holmes Gillett.
I think it's best to just tell him I'm pregnant.
Who is the father?
Polly Bleeker?
I think he had it in him.
I know, right?
Wow, your shorts are like especially gold today.
My mom uses color safe bleach.
Okay. Welcome back, everyone, to an exciting new installment of Sleepover Cinema, talking about a movie that we have really been eager to unpack for a while now. Ever since we realized that it falls into this category, we were like, oh, shit, let's talk about this.
Maybe some of you would think it doesn't fit into this category,
but we do.
It is by far the most critically acclaimed film we will ever get on this show, probably.
Yes. Unless at some point we get desperate and we do like Lady Bird or something,
yeah.
Then maybe. But this movie, which to me feels very much like a spiritual predecessor to Lady Bird, was a really interesting movie for us to get into. But before we get into all the facts and figures for this movie, we just want to bring up that we are having our very first live trivia event on Friday, August 13th. It's going to be co-hosted by us and Darren of Under the Tree with DXC. You will recognize him from our Bring It On episode. He's a really good trivia writer, and it's going to be on Zoom, so you can come no matter where you are, and it will be fun, and there will be a Sleepover Cinema goodie bag for the winner, so you should come win it.
It's going to be a good time on Friday, August 13th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but you can register at the link in our bio.
Yes. And also, today's a little bit different because I did not do the research for this episode. Audrey did. So she is going to guide us through the facts and figures surrounding this movie. So, Audrey, would you like to take us away?
Yes. All right. So, Juno was released theatrically on December 5th, 2007 in the U.S. The rollout of Juno is a little bit different than the movies we usually cover because it is considered an indie film. So a lot of times indie films that end up getting theatrical releases go on the film festival circuit first and like gather all their acclaim and hype. And that is what allows them to cross into the theatrical distribution world. So yes. Juno premiered at Telluride Film Festival. It went to Toronto Film Festival, Austin, and it also was played at a lot of international film festivals. As far as the Oscars go, it was nominated for Best Picture, Best Actress, Directing, and Best Screenplay. It actually won Best Screenplay. And I was just thinking how funny it is that we've never been able to talk about the Oscars on this show. Not once. So the fact that it is critically acclaimed and Sleepover Cinema approved is rare.
Very rare.
Juno was directed by Jason Reitman, who is known for Up in the Air and Thank You for Smoking as a director, but he also is an executive producer, and it seems that him and Diablo Cody have an established working relationship. He was the executive producer on Jennifer's Body and also Whiplash, which is not Diablo Cody, but it's a good movie.
But good.
Yeah. And
J.K. Simmons. Hey, there's a connection.
Yes. They're definitely all like a network of people
in
who
cahoots,
like
sure.
to work together. And then he's also executive producing an unspecified HBO Diablo Cody TV series in the near future, which is very exciting. And yes. Diablo Cody had, I don't know that she's been like out of the game per se, but she certainly is experiencing a resurgence in popularity. So I like this makes a lot of sense to me.
Definitely.
Juno was produced by 10 people, and that is kind of a common thing also for indie films where they have a lot of support from people in the industry, but they don't have a ton of money. So that's when you'll end up having like a lot of people pulling favors and then getting producer credits because there's like no like real way to financially compensate them. So I listed the top three. And that's Joseph Drake, who produced Juno and all the Hunger Games movies. Daniel Dubiecki, who obviously produced Juno. I'm listing them for Juno. Juno, Up in the Air, and Money Monster. And then we have Leanne Hafon. And this one makes a lot of sense to me because of what her most popular works are. Juno, Perks of Being a Wallflower, and Ghost World. Like that...
Yes.
That is perfect for this movie. Like, it makes sense. And then Juno was written by Diablo Cody, who I feel like there's a lot of kind of like intrigue around, kind of, especially now. Yes. Maybe people knew more about her in 2007 and around those years. But Hannah, what do you like? What comes to mind when you think of Diablo Cody?
Diablo Cody?
Yeah.
To me, the thing that comes to mind when I think of Diablo Cody is the dialogue style. Like, I'll get into it more when we start talking about the movie, but I think of woman/girl-centered, really strong dialogue, kind of quirky and like a little bit before its time stylistically. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that I think of.
Yeah, me too. So, most notably, Diablo Cody is the writer of Juno, Young Adult, Tully, and Jennifer's Body, which if you watch the show, obviously you know and have seen the surge of appreciation and just love towards Jennifer's Body and Megan Fox because she has a movie that recently came out. And so in all her press stuff, I've been watching her in like all the press videos, and she's just... She always talks about Jennifer's Body and how much she loves that movie. And then I found this, like, I forget what it was on, but I found somebody who had written what her trademark is as a writer, and I feel like they really nailed it. Mm-hmm. And they said, her writing frequently centers on a woman or girl with a public and obvious external struggle who is also hiding a much more personal internal struggle. That is like right on the money. Yeah. And then this is a fun fact, but Diablo Cody is not her actual name. So apparently the name Diablo Cody, it became her pen name, and she invented it while speeding through Cody, Wyoming, listening to the song El Diablo by Arcadia. Somehow stuck those names together. It is a cool name, honestly.
Yes, I totally agree.
And then I kind of want to just outline like her career path because it is pretty bizarre, I guess, when you think about the typical person who becomes an Oscar-winning screenwriter. She wrote blogs for a long time, like while she was working normal day jobs and all that stuff. She would write blogs under like alias names, and like they were pretty autobiographical, but you wouldn't really know, basically. It was like anonymous. Yeah. And then she ended up quitting her day job and becoming a stripper, and she would write blogs about that. She would just like write using her life experiences, basically. And then she ended up writing for a newspaper, which led to writing an article for, I think it was a weekly column for Entertainment Weekly. And then she wrote a memoir, which got her a manager who is the first person who encouraged her to write a screenplay. So...
And that's how we've received these gems in our lives.
Yeah. So it's a meandering path, but I think it's interesting and like rare.
Yeah, definitely. And then there's one other thing on this outline that, so, okay, obviously this episode is going to get into reproductive rights. Like, that is just what a thing we are going to talk about. So maybe if you have experiences with pregnancy or having been pregnant, or if it's like a sensitive subject for you, maybe skip this one. But anyway, specifically, I guess in 2019, after this anti-abortion law was signed into law in 2019. It was this specific law where abortion was banned past the 6-week mark, which, like, for reference, that means that if your period is 2 weeks late and you haven't figured it out yet, it's too late for you to get an abortion. Like, it's really, 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 really early, and it's very inhumane. It's an inhumane law. Mm-hmm. And Diablo Cody stated that after that law was signed into, or like ratified or whatever, she regretted writing Juno as it is because the movie has been perceived as an anti-choice film, which I find really interesting. And it kind of struck me in a similar way when I was watching it. Mm-hmm. But we can get into that more when we are discussing our reactions to the movie. So anyway, just keep in mind, we will be getting into that in this episode. So, Audrey, do you want me to read the log lines?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have a good one.
No, like, okay. Honestly, they're both good. I just didn't know.
Okay, well, here's two of them. So the first one. When precocious teen Juno McGuff becomes pregnant, she chooses a failed rock star and his wife to adopt her unborn child. Complications occur when Mark, the prospective father, begins viewing Juno as more than just the mother of his future child, putting both his marriage and the adoption in jeopardy. That's accurate. That is what the movie is about.
It's accurate.
I will say that one sort of puts, like, the plot emphasis on Mark a bit more. Whereas this second one, it's much more reductive, but faced with an unplanned pregnancy, an offbeat young woman makes an unusual decision regarding the unborn child. It's not an unusual decision, really. I mean, I guess maybe it is. It kind of is.
What's unusual is the whole, like, yeah, I'm fine with a closed adoption. Like, it's like the way that Juno goes about it that is unusual.
Yeah, I guess so.
And just being, like, physically present in their house all the time. Like, it is unusual.
Yeah, I think it's more like an offbeat young woman makes unusual decisions regarding the adoption process.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. And then tagline, you gotta read it. It's your thing.
So the tagline for Juno is a comedy about growing up, .. and the bumps along the way.
Good one.
Hilarious.
Oh, man. Okay. Audrey, take us through this cast.
Okay. Well, this cast is stacked. And yes. I thought an interesting note about this movie, as I mentioned, it was relatively low budget, especially for the actors they were trying to get and did get. So a lot of them ended up taking below their standard rate because they loved the script and they were like, I just want to be a part of it. I don't really care about the payment, especially Jennifer Garner. She was like kind of the lead of that. But I'm just going to get into the cast. I'm going to list them off kind of fast because there's a lot of them. So first we have Elliot Page, who plays Juno, and he is known for Inception, Hard Candy, X-Men, and The Umbrella Academy. We've got Michael Cera, who plays Polly, who is known for Superbad, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and Nick and Nora's Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist.
Oh my god. I do want to say I want to throw Superbad into the running for a Sleepover Cinema episode because I love that movie and I have watched it at sleepovers. So
yeah, we should, honestly.
Yeah, we would probably have a good take on it.
Probably. And I haven't seen it that much. I've only seen it's it like so twice
good. Yeah.
Next, we have Jennifer Garner, who plays Vanessa. Obviously, she's in 13 Going on 30, and she's also known for Alias and Daredevil, which I have not seen. Sorry, Jennifer.
Me neither.
Next, we have Jason Bateman, who plays Mark. He's known for Arrested Development, Bad Words, and Zootopia.
Oh, he is known for Zootopia.
We got J.K. Simmons, who's playing Juno's father for La La Land, Spider-Man, and Whiplash. Mostly Whiplash. I feel like at least people our age would think of him.
This makes so much more sense. Whiplash. I was like, wait, what? Yeah. Okay, got it.
And then we have Allison Janney, who plays Juno's stepmom. And she's most known for The Help, Hairspray, and The Hours. She's also in a movie that I recently... Well, I didn't really recently work on it, but it came out recently, and it's called Breaking News in Yuba County. It's not a good movie, but if you watch it, my name is in the credits. So
hey,
that's
fancy.
Fun. And then we have Olivia Thirlby, who plays Leah, who's Juno's best friend, and she is best known for No Strings Attached, Dread, and The Whackness.
Wow.
But I love her. I just want to say that
yeah,
I really
she's great
like her
in this movie.
And she deserves more roles. And
yes.
Then I also wanted to note the random Rainn Wilson appearance. Like,
he really is very memorable.
Yeah, he's good. All right, do you want to do the budget stuff?
You do the budget and then I'll do the reviews.
Okay, so the budget for Juno was a mere $7,500,000. So pitiful and sad. Just kidding. The box office opening weekend was $413,869. And that's only because it premiered in 7 theaters. And that is also common.
Got it.
For a film of this type. But... good news, the overall worldwide gross is $232,372,681.
Wow.
So, yeah, safe to say it was a hit, and that's incredible.
Wow.
And Diablo Cody should have gotten, like, 40 projects from that. I mean, I'm sure she did. I'm sure she did offers-wise. But like
probably
that kind of success is really rare in this
Definitely.
Particular range. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
In this particular lane.
Yeah, I mean this movie made a really, really big cultural impact for certain as well. Like one thing about it that I feel when I was watching it is when we first saw this movie, or when I first saw this movie, I was really struck by the dialogue and I was like, whoa, no one talks like this. Like, mm-hmm. This is so out there. But when I listen to it now, I'm like, oh, this is how people talk.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's just because I grew up or if her movies did make that big of an impact on like media in general. I feel like it did make a really big impact in her kind of like flair sort of bled into other media for the same audience.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. So,
yeah,
hell yeah
it
for her.
It definitely did.
Yeah. So, okay, now into these reviews. So, I think that this is the highest critic score we have ever had on a Sleepover Cinema episode. This movie received a 94% critic score on Rotten Tomatoes and is generally praised for its charm. And the critic consensus is as follows. One of the brightest, funniest comedies of the year, Juno's smart script and direction are matched by assured performances and a coming-of-age story with a 21st century twist. Andrew Mail of Empire says, a sharp-edged, sweet-centered, warm-hearted coming-of-age movie that's always just a little bit smarter than you think it is, which is such a classic thing for someone to say.
Yeah.
Like, it's about a girl and it's about a teenage girl and it's not stupid. Like, can you believe it?
Yeah.
And then the next one, Matthew Lucas from The Front Row. Whereas most people have seen charm and wit, I saw self-conscious quirkiness and an excessive smugness that I found off-putting. So, okay, I kind of get what he's saying because
yeah.
At the time, I cannot emphasize enough, like, listening to the dialogue, you're like, oh, they, like they really think they're doing something here. Like, you can kind of get that vibe from it if that's what you're looking for. But I think that it has aged really, really well. So jokes on Matthew Lucas.
Yeah.
And last but not least, Roger Ebert said it was the best movie of the year. So take it from our king. When he tells you the truth, you have no choice but to ingest it because you know Ebert knows best. So now, with audience score, there was an 88%. Audrey, would you like to detail this a little bit?
Yes. So as I scroll through all of the audience reviews, I see the same things over and over and over again, which is like, great writing, great cast, a refreshing take on this type of story, you know? And then you'll get like a few one-offs in there. And I found this one, which I felt like it has the energy of like, if Diablo Cody had, because Diablo Cody studied like media and film, like whoever Diablo Cody's peers are that are like mad that she's successful. Yeah. That's like what I get from this. So this is what they said. My name is Diablo or something. I used to strip. Now I write witty scripts for second-rate actors to be in. Marvel at my ability to write quirky lines for my quirky characters to say. Fall in love with the quirky hamburger phone. Be amazed at all the quirky music choices the movie has to offer you. Remember, I used to strip. Isn't that quirky?
God, they're mad. They're so mad. You know what, though? I feel like that is so in the style of, like, the popular misogyny of that time. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of like the precursor to, like, the pick me girl thing or, like, the not like other girls thing. But I feel like, and I can, I mean, I don't want to say, like, I can see it, but, like, I remember what that whole thing was like. And it's kind of like, so I, like, hated Zooey Deschanel in high school and middle school.
I literally was thinking of her. I was about to bring up New Girl or something.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. And I feel like that sort of, like, girl who's, like, quirky but hot thing has kind of died out. But that was, like, Zooey Deschanel's pocket. Like, that was her whole thing. And I feel like this movie was even more extreme than that. It just, there's a really certain flavor to this kind of criticism that I understand because I was there for it, but at the same time, it just comes off really bitter. So.
And I think it was appealing at the time. Like it was, it was easy. It's just easy.
Yes.
To feel that way.
So Audrey, what was the goss at the time?
So 2007 is a year absolutely packed with celebrity drama. But I was thinking it can pretty much be summarized as the media exploiting women nonstop. Just over and over and over again. We have the Justin Timberlake, Cameron Diaz split. Sadly, Anna Nicole Smith passed away in 2007. Lindsay Lohan went to rehab. Vanessa Hudgens' nudes were leaked. Britney shaved her head and Jamie Lynn got pregnant. And these are all within the same year.
Wow.
And so I feel like at the time, obviously this has been very overanalyzed in the past year or so because everyone like is into this stuff. But the climate for like being a human being in media at the time was god awful.
Yes. It was like basically the last gasps of like the tabloid era because like social media wasn't really a thing yet. And I feel like this was the time when like the paparazzi stalking and like the general pressure was like at its highest probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like nobody with social media, it's kind of like you're stalking yourself. Like you're like.
Right. Or like you're choosing what to share.
Yeah.
It's also really interesting at the same time, like social media wasn't a huge thing yet, but it was enough to the point where Vanessa Hudgens's nudes being leaked was a thing that could happen and made a big impact. It's kind of so much of a hellscape because the Venn diagram of social media age and tabloid age was still
overlapping.
It was still in the middle portion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunate.
Yeah. It's like they suffered the worst of both worlds in a way.
Definitely. I mean, also Jamie Lynn being pregnant and ending Zooey 101 is sort of, I mean, just the fact that teen pregnancy was so in the zeitgeist at the time, like, I think like the novelty of being able to talk about it on TV or like in shows was still there, like without it just being taboo. What I'm trying to say is teen pregnancy was very much a topic in everyone's minds. And I'm pretty sure this is when Secret Life of the American Teenager was happening too.
Yeah, I think what you're trying to get at is that like although Juno could be viewed as like an anti-choice film now, at that time, it was like a refreshing take on this type of storyline.
Yes, definitely. Like, she wasn't traumatized. Well, she wasn't like leading with her fear and trauma about being pregnant.
Yeah.
Which was rare.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Audrey, what do you remember about when you saw this movie the first time?
I don't remember anything about when I saw this movie the first time. I don't even know when I saw it for the first time, but I don't think it was... I think I was relatively young. Like, I think I was probably in middle school or something.
I mean, it came out in December of 2017, so you would have been halfway through fifth grade when it came out.
2017.
Shit, sorry, 2007. You would have been halfway through fifth grade.
Yeah. I think maybe I saw it in like 2010 or 2011 or 2012, something like that.
Yeah. So this movie came out when I was halfway through seventh grade, and I feel like this movie, along with 500 Days of Summer and like Superbad, sort of fit into like my later sleepover movie category. Like, when I think of this movie, I think of my high school best friend, Allie. If you're listening, hello. The soundtrack is so just violently.
Yeah, it's violent.
2007, like unrelenting slacker folk music. Like, yeah. Oh my God. I think of that. I think of how Juno as a character was like the blueprint in a lot of ways about like how to be not like other girls.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, we can talk about this after the fact, but there is more to the actor playing Juno than, and I feel like, right. I feel like knowing Elliot's history now, it like makes sense. But the totally. Way that that contributed to a not like other girls, like culture.
Like literally not like other girls.
Is really interesting. Yeah. Like it's really it's interesting true. Now.
It is. And also, how interesting is it that his first role was specifically like his, well, not his first role, but like this big, big, big role for him was like specifically about pregnancy.
Yeah. Like the anatomy of a woman.
Yes. Just much to think about.
Yeah.
So, okay. There is so much to talk about with this movie. And if you have not seen it, it is available like only on Amazon Prime and you have to rent it, right?
I don't know. You looked it up.
Yes. So that was the only thing I could find. So go. Maybe you have an old DVD from like years and years ago. Just go find it.
Oh my gosh. Go to the library.
Oh yeah. Duh. Go to the library if you're so fortunate. And get a copy and then circle on back and we will unpack this movie together.
Hello, everyone. My name is Matt Neglia, and I am the host of the Next Best Picture podcast, part of the Film Entertainment Awards website, nextbestpicture.com. On our show, we explore all year long what is possibly going to win Best Picture at the Oscars. We do this by conducting interviews with people within the film industry, holding weekly reviews of the latest theatrical releases, and on our main show, where we dive into various different topics, answer your fan questions, and also do our best to explore Oscar history's past in hopes that it will tell us something new for this upcoming award season race. We hope that you will join us on all of the various podcasting networks. We look forward to seeing you over at nextbestpicture.com.
We are back, everyone, ready to just dive headfirst into 2007's best screenplay winner, a rarity for this program. So let's start with the good things. For me, I mostly have a lot of notable things, but Audrey, you go first, and maybe I'll just react to your things.
I like the intro sequence. I think there are moments where I would think it's like too much, maybe, mm-hmm. or like it's like trying to be something it's not. I don't know. But I think on this past watch, I felt like it was a good stylistic choice.
Like what specifically? The animation?
Yeah, the animation and just having the intro sequence be that long.
Yeah.
And like really getting into it. Like it's kind of like a tone. It's like a, this is what our tone is going to be. And so like get right. on board type
right.
of thing.
Right. When I watched it, I was on mom and dad's elliptical in the basement at their house, and I turned off all the lights. So I was like working out in the dark, but watching Juno on my laptop from across the room. And I was watching that animated opening sequence and just thinking about how that like aesthetic was such a thing in like 2007, like through like 2010, 2011. It kind of reminds me of the season slides in 500 Days of Summer. Mm-hmm. It's like a similar thing. And it, you know, it just takes me back to like my mod cloth, like handlebar mustache high school experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, early high school experience. And that's an unfortunate part of my past, but I'm here to own up to it today on Sleepover Cinema. So Anyway, Audrey, what else?
The line went, you know how Juno's best friend, Leah, they're talking about how she loves teachers. Like she yes. like, has crushes on teachers. When she says, oh my gosh, I love Woody Allen.
Yes, I wrote that down too.
That was so funny.
Like it's so on the nose. But yeah, great.
It was so on the nose. And like, I think that's why it stuck out to us, is because you aren't expecting the line to be so on the nose, but it works.
Right. Right. And like a bit more edgy to be that on the nose in 2007 compared to now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing about watching it this time through, I mean, I hadn't seen it since probably before college. So I have learned a lot, seen a lot of films and listened to other music and like grown a lot with my references. And so the B-roll that they use, like the style that they chose is like Juno will be talking about something and you'll see like B-roll clips of it.
Yeah.
Which I like. It's like a documentary type of twist to to a narrative film. But the references, I caught them, almost all of them this time.
Ooh.
And I was like, ha-ha, I don't know what that means, but I feel smart this time.
Yes.
One thing I really appreciated and kind of like basically Jennifer Garner in this movie like broke my heart. And I was like, this is so sad. And she did such a good job. Like that scene in the mall is so, where she's like trying to feel the baby. It's like so sad.
It is really sad.
And also very heartwarming at the same time.
Yeah.
I noticed some really bold, like full fade choices, like at the end of a scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would just go a full fade to black and sound as well, like no crossover with the next scene. And I was like, and the mall is a good example of that. Like at the end of the mall scene, it's a shot of Juno's face, like reacting to Vanessa, who feels the baby, and then it goes completely to black. And I was like, yeah, that's a good choice.
Yeah.
But whenever I see that, it's like a little jarring. But then you think, well, it's there for a reason. Like, we're supposed to, like, ruminate on that a little bit.
That moment had gravitas, and now they're telling us just in case we hadn't felt it.
Yeah, they're telling us to think about it for a second. The shot of the girl who has a stink eye.
Yes.
That was so well planted in there. I really...
Yeah.
It was the kind of like absurdist thing that would be in like Napoleon Dynamite or something.
Yes. Oh my God. Wait. So I actually wrote down that I felt like this movie had like, there were some stylistic reverberations of Napoleon Dynamite in the way that this movie was shot.
Which makes sense timeline wise.
Totally. Totally.
And like, if I had been an indie filmmaker, then I would have definitely probably tried to go for something in that tone.
Yeah.
Although then you kind of look a little derivative. That's the only issue with it.
Yeah.
But like, Juno does a good job of channeling that energy without feeling derivative of other movies.
Yeah. Right.
I cried.
Girl, I cried.
So
when did you cry?
I can't even remember now. I think I was like fighting it back. I was fighting for my life watching this movie.
Yeah.
I think the mall scene might have been one of them. I don't remember. But yeah, it's just generally, it kind of got me.
Yeah. Do you have any other good things?
That was the end.
Okay. Mine were... Oh, okay. Well, so I already said the thing about the dialogue. I feel like the dialogue has aged really, really well, and it struck me as way less quirky as it once was. Mm-hmm. There were just parts of the script that were just so 2007 that just, like, I could even say it's a bad thing, but to me, because of, you know, we're nostalgic people, it just got me. And one of those things was when Leah and Juno are sitting in the park and they're looking at the penny savers.
Yeah.
And Juno describes the ideal couple that yeah. she wants to take her baby. And she's like, you know, like 35-year-old graphic designer guy with like a cool Asian girlfriend who rocks out on the bass guitar. I was like, no. But also, like, that is so how things were at the time. Like, for some reason, like, Asian girlfriends, like, cool Asian girlfriends on bass, like, that was such a weird thing that came up all the time. Probably because of Weezer, to be totally honest.
Yeah. I think that is why.
I was just kind of like, LMAO, I feel like I'm
embarrassed.
I was embarrassed. Yeah. There was this book that Allie Miller had I said her last name, whatever. Again, if she's here, she knows what I'm talking about. But there was this book that she had that was like the guide to being emo or something, but it was like, or like hipsters. And it was like different types of like alternative people with like illustrations and diagrams and stuff. And I'll like find it and link to it in the episode description or something. Cause if you are my age, like 25 and were ever emo at all, you will really appreciate this book. But anyway, just this book and this movie just go together in my mind. And anyway, I'm kind of rambling, but whatever. It's a moment in my brain. And then I also just in general appreciated that Juno as a character is like demonstrated to not have daddy issues.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great. Obviously, she has some weird stuff with her mom, which I think is more relevant to the story. But like, I just love that the thing with Mark doesn't have to do with her not having a father that loves her.
Yeah.
Because clearly her father is like very present and cares a lot.
Yeah. And their reaction to it, both of them, is really good.
Yes.
Like, definitely. They're like, well, all right. I guess we're
going
to. You
mean Juno's parents?
Yeah.
Yeah, the only thing is when they were like, well, I hoped that she had like hit someone with her car or like done something
yeah.
or something. And I'm like, honestly, this is like not that bad. Like,
no.
Yeah. When we get to the notable section, we can talk about the anti-choice thing again. I would like to. But the bad stuff. Did you have anything written under bad?
Yeah, a few things, but it's not like for real. It's not like that serious. But yeah. I was saying, I don't really know if I buy the best friendship between Leah and Juno. It's like, they're fun and they definitely have a similar sense of humor. But like, you just look at like the landscape of high school and like generally what that would be. And like, mm-hmm. I don't really see it for them, but
yeah,
we'll go with it. And like, I'm sure there are similar friendships in the world, but like, I was
right.
like, it's just kind of rare. I noticed that this time I felt a lot more conflicted about the inappropriate relationship between Mark and Juno.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but I realize now, like, this doesn't belong in the worst category. It's not, like, worse. It's just, like, I have a much higher awareness. Because back in the day, like, I would watch movies like this and not really think about how that relationship is a part of like a long history of similar relationships in the world. Uh-huh. Like, I would think about it like, no, we're watching Juno the individual and Mark the individual. Like, I didn't think about things as much in their systems and like how things work in the world because I didn't have that knowledge back then.
Yes.
This time I felt a lot more scared for her, I think.
I really was very struck by what it is that actually sort of brought Juno and Mark together in this story more this time around. Like, the fact that Juno is, like, so hell-bent on growing up and, like, being done with high school and, like, being the coolest person and all that, but, like, in her own unique way, and the way that Mark is, like, embarrassed of his circumstances also and, like, wants to go back and, like, wants a do-over. Like, it interacts in a very interesting way, like those two motivations.
Yeah, it's like they're both trying to like come towards the middle. Like if they could meet in the middle, he's trying to age down and she's trying to age up, be more mature. Like,
yes. I also wrote under bad that I got sick of the soundtrack kind of fast.
Oh, that's what I wrote too. That was my last thing. I wrote, it becomes a little heavy-handed on the indie singer-songwriter music.
It really does. And the thing is, like, it wasn't even like, okay, I'm sorry. I am sorry, but it's not even like good singer-songwriter music. No. It's like, I went to the mall because I wanted a smoothie and you didn't like me, so I went to sleep. Like, that's it. The entire time with like shitty acoustic guitar. And I'm like, okay, this could be like if 1/3 of the soundtrack was this, it would
be
fine.
Acceptable, but it's every song.
But it's every single song.
They ate it up in 2007, but they're literally I went to McDonald's and I saw you. Then I got on my bike and went to school.
Honestly, the amount of parodies we could make if I had my guitar with me too, like we could make a whole episode just of like Juno song parodies, like without even trying.
It would not be hard. You could say anything.
Yes. It's just such a moment though. Like it really was such a moment in the culture for sure. Okay. But notable things. What did you have?
I think you've like created this category of notable things that I don't have.
Okay. So I guess I'll just go through mine. So, oh boy. Okay. So I'm sitting here thinking and looking at my list and trying to deliberate the amount of personal information to disclose to the Sleepover Cinema audience. But I think that the biggest difference for me between having watched it a long time ago, the last time I watched this was probably high school, and now, is that I have had an accidental pregnancy and have gone through this process. I did not have a child. I had an abortion and it was totally fine. It was literally 1000% fine, but it was a kind of messy situation at the very beginning. So just looking back on it now or watching the movie now, like one thing that I found really funny with my life experience now is the part where Leah's like, okay, so Juno, like, where are you going to go to get your abortion? And she's like, you know, I think I'm going to go to Women Now because they help women now. Because like that really is like what these places are named. And I found that to be really amusing. And I think the thing that I was like really sitting with though is like, I didn't really get it. Like when she goes into the clinic and the thing that drives her away is like people like sniffing and like scratching and stuff. I was like,
it's like a false correlation. But I think they're just trying to portray anxiety. I think that's it.
It kind of made me feel like they were trying to, like, it came across to me like Juno has like a sensory thing where like she can't like handle that. I'm like, are they trying to say that she like has some other shit going on? So I found that to be weird. I also just kind of felt like Juno as a character would not be deterred by the girl outside the clinic saying lies, yeah, which is that embryos have fingernails.
Yeah.
Like, I just didn't really buy that that would happen. Like, it just seems a bit extreme. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, to Diablo's point about this being like an anti-choice movie, I will say that one thing that really struck me is that, like, they make it seem like just having a baby and giving it up for adoption is like a manageable choice for a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
And like, it totally can be. It is 100% up to the person who's pregnant. But like, it's not, it doesn't impede in her life as much as it realistically would.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, why, how is she, her dad is just letting her do like everything too. Her dad is just like, yeah, you can just drive the minivan hours away all the time when you're literally about to burst. Also, the amount, she gets big so fast.
Well, they do have the whole, like, the seasons progression.
But, like, because of how much we don't see, she gets big really fast. And then it feels like her mental state hasn't developed the same level that her body has. Like, at that point, you would have gone through some shit pregnancy-wise, and we don't see anything relating to the process of growing a fetus. So,
well, you kind of do, like, in, like, the throwing up in Bren's urn thing. And, like, you kind of do with, like, the ultrasound scene, which I do love that scene.
Mm, me too.
But I just...
But, like, not really. Not, like, the daily trials and tribulations.
Yeah. I think the anti-choice, like angle is sort of, like, look, like, this quirky alternative liberal girl did it. Like,
yeah.
Like, just have the baby, you know? And it's just, at the time, I agree with what we said earlier, that, like, it was a refreshing take on this sort of story. I think that now it is a little bit
different. It's reductive.
It's a bit reductive, yeah. But at the same time,
it's, like, partly refreshing that they're not leading with trauma, but it's just naive.
It's also, like, inaccurate, but it's also, like, God forbid, like, this is a thing that happens to people all the time. Like, I'm a perfect example. Like, this sort of thing happens all the time, and for some people it's a big deal, for some people it's not a big deal. And I think the fact that it is a thing that happens to Juno, but at the end of the story, she's happy, it's okay, and she's kind of, like, chosen to embrace her childhood by being with Polly and, like, mm-hmm. not trying to rush through things, I find that to be nice still. I think that that still holds up by her not being, like, ruined by what happened to her. I also just, another thing that made me feel like Juno wouldn't have had this baby is when she's talking about choosing to have the baby. And she's like, yeah, maybe, well, they'll all canonize me for being so selfless that I, like, had this baby. But the thing is, it's kind of, it is like reemphasizing the stigma by being like, it's selfish to have an abortion. Mm-hmm. Like, that is sort of, like, the implication beneath it. Which it's not. It's literally just your choice in life. But it was 2007. It's fine. We don't need to beat the shit out of it.
Those stigmas are obviously still extremely present. So, like, the fact that you can literally be somebody who's pregnant, who knows that they want to have an abortion and goes and gets one, and still have all those, like, stigmatized thoughts in your mind. Or, you know, like, you can be prejudiced against yourself.
Yes, you totally can. That is absolutely true. There's, like, layers and layers and layers to all of this. And it's something that I'm even still sort of encountering challenges with. Like, I've been volunteering with Pro-Choice NARAL Ohio. And even in the work we do there, I'm on the Digital Organizing Council. Sometimes, like, they'll, like, obviously on this team, we're very, very, very pro-choice. And even sometimes for me, like, stuff will kind of hit, like, a sensitive spot, or mm-hmm. or I'll just discover, like, new pockets of stigma that I've internalized that I, like, didn't even realize were there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a deep well of shit. So
yeah, and it's like the type of thing that you can really easily not confront in yourself if it doesn't happen to you.
Yes, that is so true. It's complicated. It's so complicated. This is more than you all bargained for.
And it obviously too, like, is very much influenced by religion, which is not something that they really get into in the movie. It's only kind of alluded to by the girl outside of Women Now.
Yes.
But they don't really get into it, which I kind of appreciate, only because that it has very much been done in a way. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. I wasn't missing it, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it could have gone that way. Like, imagine if, like, the stepmom was really religious or something.
Yeah. But you know what? I was so happy that she wasn't antagonized in this movie. She's, like, one of the best characters.
I know. She's so fun and, she's like, so great. Supportive. But, like, a very real stepmom. Like, she's a very real mother figure.
Yes, I totally agree. I have, like, a kind of, like, statement for the conclusion, but before we do that, what about problematic things? Do you have any?
I mean, when you're dealing with, like, a self-aware movie that is, that the central themes are, you know, controversial topics or, like, taboo things, if they're handled well, you know, generally speaking, it's not going to be perceived as problematic. Like, what's going on is problematic, but the way that it was handled in the movie was fair. I think it was fair. And generally speaking, I think it's aged well, other than the fact that watching it now, it can be perceived as anti-choice. But I think that mostly people who would come away with that would not really be thinking about the climate of when it was released. But, you know, you can still stand by that. Like, I'm sure there were people in 2007 who thought the same thing, obviously.
Yeah.
So
definitely. My only nitpicky problematic thing is that I hated that she shat on Polly's mom for being fat.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, why are we?
Oh, yeah. She was like, she was like needlessly brutalizing.
Yeah. She was like, Mrs. Bleeker was probably really pretty at some point, but now she's just like a fat Muppet or something like that.
Like a Lord of the Rings character or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It was like the Hobbit or something.
Yeah.
I was like, what if you just said that she was a bitch or, like, not a bitch, but, like, what if she was just mean?
What if you just had, like, a bad experience with her? Like, it didn't need to be about her physicality.
Yeah, totally. So that was really all I had with problematic, but kind of, like, the thing that... So, okay... You cried watching this movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you cry at the end?
I don't think so. It's weird. I, like, already forget when I cried. That's because I cry a lot.
I also cry a lot, but I don't really cry at movies that much.
Yeah.
And I cried when she had the baby. I am not speaking for all people who have had abortions in this moment, but just... from my own lived experience, like, just a little bit of background, I found out I was pregnant with an IUD in. So that is not how it's supposed to work.
No.
But that is how it happened. And I was in Florida with my family at the time, but Audrey was not there.
No.
It was my parents and me and Josh, who's my boyfriend. And it was, like, really into us dating, or really early into us dating. Found out I was pregnant, had to go, because when you get pregnant with an IUD in, everyone's like, you gotta call in for reinforcements. It could be an ectopic pregnancy. Like, your uterus could explode at any minute, or, like, your fallopian tubes. Because when you, it was this whole thing. And so we were, like, in the emergency room in Sarasota, Florida. And it was really, really stressful. And then I had to come back to Ohio. So I got to be in two red states for this experience.
Yeah.
And, basically, it was really hard to find care because of the fact that I had this IUD in, and the laws are really weird in Ohio. And it was just like a very stressful experience from the medical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But it ended up being totally fine. Like, it was not pleasant, but it really was not bad. And I really don't think about it that often. People can do this, and it really does not have to be trauma or anything. But I think the thing that, like, the one bittersweet element of the situation for me that I kind of felt like was a little bit represented in the ending of Juno was, like, after Juno has the baby, and at the beginning where she's like, and when I'm using she, it's because I'm talking about Juno, the character. She's like, I didn't tell Polly that I was having the baby because he, like, had a track meet. And, like, mm-hmm. I wanted him to do well. Like, that I just appreciated. But then also, like, when he came to the hospital afterward and she was, like, laying there and was, like, being sad because they, like, chose to not see the baby. And, like, it's not clarified whether she's crying because she didn't see the baby or whether she's crying because it was stressful or maybe she's mm-hmm. just tired. Like, you don't really know what it is. But, like, for me, kind of how it landed was, like, in life, I would love to have a child. Like, and I definitely plan on doing that at some point. And, like, as long as nothing horribly goes wrong, like, I do plan on that being with Josh. And so, like, the experience mm-hmm. of it, of, like, getting pregnant and, like, it being with the IUD and it being, like, super unprovoked, if you will, and being, like, this could have been really, really, really great news. Like, this could have been cool because I really like this person that I'm with. But, like, now is not the time. Like, I was 23 and just, like, no. Like, how fucking no? That I just felt... like, that struck that sort of emotional nerve for me. But then, like, they continue to go on and, like, have good times together and be happy. And, like, Vanessa is happy because she has this baby. And, like, mm-hmm. it works out for everyone. And, like, everyone moves on. It just, it made me feel good and emotional. And it's just a perspective that I never could have had on this if I was watching it 10 years ago, which I also did watch it 10 years ago. So,
yeah,
that's kind of my, like, my personal experience tie-in. But yeah, so that's kind of emo. But I really only am being so bold about talking about this here because, like, I feel like a lot of people aren't comfortable talking about the fact that they've had abortions if they've had them. And it's really mm-hmm. important to me to, like, share it with people because if you don't know anyone who's had one, it can be really scary to think about. And, you know, I'm living proof, baby. It can be totally fine. And it is fine. Mm-hmm. So that's my spiel. But Juno is good representation.
Yeah.
Even though she doesn't have an abortion.
In a way.
The movie is not about abortion at all.
No. But you know what? We've got many, many, many road trip abortion movies in the recent years.
Yes, we do.
And, like, yes, I get it. It is important. And it's a good premise, too. But at this point, I think there's too many. Also, the people who star in them, it's always white girls.
Oh my God. Yeah. Okay, wait. That's one thing that I actually did want to bring up.
Yeah.
Which is, okay, we didn't even talk about the fact that this movie is, like, extremely white, first of all. It's the whitest movie ever. And this is the whole thing, is that it's, like, the fact that she, like, we still respect Juno as a character in 2007 because she's, like, a clever white girl who has a family that's present, who she is, like, in love with the guy who she had sex with. Like, there is this whole... Mm-hmm. like mythos around like a good pregnancy or like a good abortion or like if you're pregnant in circumstances that you weren't anticipating being pregnant, like there's just so many intersections that come into play of how this shit is received.
Yeah. Yeah. Like this is so palatable.
Totally.
For the general public. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's also a thing that I've thought about a lot too in my experience in like organizing. Like, I've barely done any at this point, but like, I can get on this podcast and talk about the fact that I had an abortion without it being so scary because A, I had an IUD in. So it was like an act of God. And also, I was like with my boyfriend who, like, we're still together to this day and like had health insurance, like, everything was taken care of. Like, it wasn't.
Yeah, it wasn't there's like traumatic. Factors that contribute.
There's so many factors that play into it. I think that that is also definitely true of this movie. Like, I don't think it would have won Best Picture if it wasn't so white. Or not Best Picture. It would not have won Best Screenplay if it wasn't so white. You know?
You're doing revisionist history over here.
I know. But I'm correcting myself every time, so.
Wait, it's also funny to look at. You look at the movies that it was nominated against for Best Picture, it's like There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men and like these like just the most male, you know, aggressive type of movies that are generally nominated for Best Picture. Obviously, since 2007, 2008, we've had a lot of progress as far as Oscar noms go, but it's nowhere near where it needs to be. But looking at Juno in that lineup, it's like Juno was the most woke thing ever. Like,
yeah, totally.
You know, like, this movie is so off the path of what usually would be nominated. So it kind of knocked, it started like knocking at that ceiling. But yeah, and watching it now, it's like, oh.
Audrey, would you like to read this citation from King Roger?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll okay. end on this. Roger Ebert wrote a really nice review for Juno, and it's something about when he writes really glowing reviews, it like brings me joy. So here's his quote from his review on Juno. There are moments of instinctive lightning comedy. Bren's response to a nurse's attitude during Juno's sonar scan and her theory about doctors when Juno wants a painkiller during childbirth. Moments that blindside us with truth, as when Mac and Juno talk about the possibility of true and lasting love. Moments that reveal Polly as more than he seems. What he says when Juno says he's cool and doesn't even need to try. And the breathtaking scene when Juno and Vanessa run into each other in the mall and the future of everyone is essentially decided. Jennifer Garner glows in that scene.
Yep, it is true.
I thought that summed it up really well.
So are we in agreement that this movie is still good and worthwhile?
Yeah. I think there's reasons that it is, like, regardless of any hindsight issues it has, they're still really important, like, benchmarks in both film and culture and society and politics that kind of culminate.
Are reflected. You know,
they have, like, a cross section in this movie. So.
Yes, I agree. I hope that this movie is in like the National Archive or whatever. Mm-hmm. I feel like it does do so much about communicating the time period. And, you know, it fits into the canon of like weird pregnancy movies very nicely.
Yeah.
And also just like a great piece of art in many ways, and especially for reflecting on the career of Elliot Page, who's so talented. His performance is unreal in this movie, and it really, really does hold up, and I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Yeah, we didn't, I feel like we didn't even really touch on performances because obviously we know they're all really good, and I don't think we have
like
to state that.
Yeah, it goes without saying. Yeah. And if the discourse of my personal shit was helpful to you or informative to you, I hope that it was. I hope I'm not just like shit posting into the void about what has happened. But I think that's basically it.
Yeah, I think we've said all we can say.
Before we go, don't forget, slight tone shift, but don't forget that we do have this trivia happening on Friday, August 13th. It's going to be really, really fun. I cannot emphasize enough how good Darren is at writing trivia. And we want to meet you over Zoom. Like, we really do, especially everyone who we're like DMing with every week who loves the show so much. It would be great to interact. So feel free to go to the link in our Instagram bio and you can register there and it'll be a grand old time.
So with that being said, I hope you enjoyed this review of Juno and we will be back next week with a brand new film.
Yes.
Just kidding. It's not brand new.
We're about to get into some, actually the next movie we're doing came out the same year as this movie.
Yeah. So this really two sides of the same coin. Like,
oh my God. Yeah. We're getting into we'll have some more feminism things to talk about next week, even though we didn't really even talk about feminism here, but not explicitly, but we will explicitly be talking about it in the next one. So have a good week and we will see you then.
Bye.
Bye.
You can find more from us at evergreenpodcast.com/sleepover-cinema and keep up with our latest creative projects at twopingpictures.com. If you want to watch our show as well as listen, we're on YouTube too. Search Sleepover Cinema or go to the link tree in our Instagram bio. We're on Instagram and Twitter at twopingpictures and would love to hear from you there. We're also on TikTok at Sleepover Cinema and that's really where the party is at.
And if you like the show, if it brings back evocative memories of childhood or tweendom or babysitting, share the episode with a few friends. Leave us an iTunes review telling us what movie you'd like to see us cover next, and leave us a review if you like the show, and if you don't, don't. Sleepover Cinema is a production of Evergreen Podcasts, produced, edited, and engineered by us, Hannah and Audrey Leach. Sleepover Cinema is mixed by Sean Rule Hoffman with theme music by Josh Perlman Hall. Special thanks to executive producers Michael D'Aloia and David Moss. We'll chat again soon.
Bye.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
This podcast was produced with the support of the Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit and in partnership with the Ohio Development Services Agency.